Today, September 11th, a mother travels to Ground Zero to remember the daughter she lost on that day.
She did love New York. She did love to work in the Twin Towers.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, dysfunction at U.S. intelligence agencies was a problem before 9/11, and it still is under President Trump.
The actual intelligence that he is receiving from the U.S. intelligence community is really troubling.
And how to address a bad trend during lockdown?
Domestic abuse got worse during the pandemic and lockdown.
A women's charity and a soap opera work together to raise awareness. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being here this Friday. Today at the 9/11 Memorial in New York City. The commemoration ceremony began at 8:46 a.m. That's when the first plane struck the World Trade Center 19 years ago today. Joe Biden and Mike Pence were in attendance, putting the presidential campaign on pause, at least for a day. Families who lost loved ones on 9/11 were also there.
I'm Feliciana Umansor. And I lost my daughter, Elsie Carolina Osorio Oliva. She never was sad or depressed. No, she was the spirit of my house. She did love New York. She did love to work in the Twin Towers. She brought me to her office. It was gorgeous and everything. She said, "Mommy, I won't change New York for anything else." So she was a true New Yorker. She was 27. She was in the North Tower. She called me that day thinking that it was an accident. And I was speaking with her. She was crying. She was very nervous. And I was giving her direction for fire. She was in the 83rd floor. She explained to me how bad it was. And I was giving her direction to prepare to be rescued from the smoke. When she started crying, and I said, "Are you alone in the office?" She said, "No." And I said, "Run to your co-worker. They will hug you." And then I saw the other airplane hit the other tower. It means she never was found. This is the only place that I can come to visit her. It's painful. For me, it's always painful to see only her name. But I'm happy that they did at least allow us to come, even with the pandemic that is really, really bad. I'm grateful for that. Because otherwise, I don't know what to do this day.
Feliciana Umansa, who lost her daughter 19 years ago today in Lower Manhattan. When it comes to national security, most experts agree 9/11 was an intelligence failure. Just this week, a whistleblower made some news, saying officials at the Department of Homeland Security are downplaying certain threats in their briefs to President Trump, specifically about Russian interference in U.S. politics and the threat posed by white supremacists. So from 9/11 to today, are intelligence agencies doing better? Garrett Graff is the author of The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11.
The CIA, for instance, knew that two of the would-be 9/11 hijackers were inside the United States in the summer of 2001 and did not tell the FBI. So it's possible that had that information been passed correctly agency to agency, the plot might have been disrupted without us ever understanding what the plot was that people were heading towards.
What is confirmed now by former security officials is that the dysfunction in the U.S. security apparatus was very apparent leading up to those attacks. So now in the face of new threats like those from Russia, what do you make of the whistleblower's charge that DHS was not only not briefing Trump on threats, but actually concocting threats that intelligence did not see?
I mean, this is all very troubling, in part because the two agencies, the two organizations that were specifically created in the wake of 9/11 to prevent the next 9/11 are the Department of Homeland Security and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, two organizations meant specifically to pull together pieces of the government security apparatus into a more coherent and understandable picture. Donald Trump's actions in a number of different ways, though, have hobbled and broken both of those organizations.
What has been the net change 19 years after 9/11 when it comes to the interoperability between U.S. intelligence agencies? Is there still dysfunction?
Much less than there was before. And some of that is because there have been legal changes to the authorities and information sharing that were specifically prohibited pre-9/11. And also there is just a much more regular rhythm of these agencies working together. And so you have organizations that are part of ODNI that have the FBI and CIA literally sitting together in the same room talking every day about what they are seeing in the counterterrorism arena. And so there's better muscle memory now under normal circumstances than there was before 9/11. Whether that information is making it to the right leaders and whether leaders are acting on it, that's a separate problem in the Trump administration.
Garrett, how do we improve things? Is it a personnel issue? Is it a leadership issue? Or do you think dysfunction may be rooted more deeply than all of that?
The dysfunction is rooted in the dysfunction and the chaos of the presidency and this White House. I think what you need to have are permanent Senate-confirmed leaders atop these organizations who have some semblance that they're actually going to be in charge of these organizations for a period of time. You know, the ability to pick their staffs and get people into these key roles.
So those are kind of the nuts and bolts of national security. Garrett, you wrote today, actually, about another kind of security threat, conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, you know, this 19th anniversary of 9/11 gives us an opportunity to look back on the legacy of those attacks. And one of the things that I think really stands out in 2020 is the role that the 9/11 truth movement, all of the conspiracy theories around the U.S. government's role in 9/11 have proved so lasting and persistent, even as a fringe movement. And as we see an increasing strain of our politics today being driven by the conspiracy theorists of QAnon on the Republican side, that should be really worrisome to us because we have sort of already seen, because of 9/11, how persistent these conspiracy theories can be as a fringe movement. And now in 2020, the QAnon conspiracy theories are actually being believed now by a majority of Republican voters and are being embraced by the president at the White House, and they actually have beginning to see members of Congress embrace them. One of the things that the dysfunction in places like DHS and ODNI is doing is giving room and oxygen for conspiracy theories like QAnon to grow in the Republican body politic, and that the embrace of the president of conspiracy theories, even as he rejects or downgrades the actual intelligence that he is receiving from the U.S. intelligence community, is really troubling.
It is hard to get to policy if you don't know what truth is. Garrett Graff writes about national security at Wired. Garrett, thanks very much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
When the pandemic began spreading across the globe earlier this year, governments everywhere rushed to provide relief services and emergency equipment to their citizens. Months later, it's becoming clear that this was a window of opportunity in many different countries for corruption and theft. As the world's Halima Gikandi tells us, a new report details what happened in South Africa.
South Africa went under strict lockdown in late March. Authorities realized early on that this would have a big impact on the country's economy, so they quickly arranged for billions of dollars in public relief, food packages, water services, and cash. But it didn't take long before accusations came out that some government officials were taking advantage of the emergency to line their pockets.
And thanks for watching Morning Live. Now, corruption and anti-corruption unit.
Allegations of corruption related to COVID-19 relief funds and food parcel.
World ANC is again trying to do damage control over corruption within its ranks. The
National Corruption in South Africa is nothing new, but some hoped that the coronavirus pandemic would be different. Zukiswa Kota is with the Public Service Accountability Monitor in the Eastern Cape, one of South Africa's poorest provinces.
Very early on, we were getting questions like, how do we know who's meant to receive what and where? How are the food parcels allocated?
In some cases, people never received the relief that was promised. Many people in South Africa suspect that was deliberate.
People saying, look, in my area, family X, Y, and Z have received food parcels more than, you know, we think they should, and we haven't at all, but that's because they support Councillor X.
This month, South Africa's Auditor General released an in-depth report on South Africa's multi-billion dollar coronavirus relief package. It confirmed there were massive irregularities. Here's Auditor General Kimmy Mkhwetu speaking at a recent press conference.
There were a number of things that already, as we are proceeding with this work on procurement, which we have identified, some of them are clear indicators of fraudulent activity,
including goods that were never delivered by contractors, possible cases of conflict of interest, questionable procurement deals, and people winning government contracts with little experience.
The unit price for some of these items of PPE, whether it was masks or whether it was any one of the other things that fall under PPE, some of them were bought at prices significantly higher than what National Treasury had advised.
Some PPE goods were bought at prices five times higher than the going rate. That news has been especially difficult to hear for South Africa's medical workers who have been facing shortages of quality protective equipment. Health workers in Pretoria recently held demonstrations against corruption. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has been outspoken. He's calling for more accountability, and he's vowed to crack down on officials who have been implicated in corruption or mismanagement of COVID goods.
I have authorized the Special Investigating Unit to probe any allegations relating to the misuse of COVID-19 funds across all spheres of the state.
But Ramaphosa has gotten some public heat, too, because his own party, the ruling African National Congress, has been at the center of the recent corruption allegations. Party members are accused of stealing or diverting food packages meant for the poor. Some have been suspended or gone on leave, including the president's own spokeswoman. Karam Singh is with the group Corruption Watch. He's based in Cape Town.
It is shocking, you know, that it happens in the context of a public health pandemic.
Shocking, but not so surprising, he says. These problems are systemic. Singh tells me that South Africa's systems for government contracts and procurement are vulnerable to those who want to take advantage of them.
Which were only going to be exacerbated by the kind of mobilization of funds and in some cases the relaxation of regulations around, in particular, how emergency procurement would take place.
Singh says the AG report is a step in the right direction, but now is the time for accountability. South Africa has a number of high-profile corruption investigations playing out. One involves the former president, Jacob Zuma. But Singh says these sorts of investigations rarely lead to convictions.
If we do see any accountability along those lines of people losing their positions, people stepping aside, then those will all be really positive developments.
South Africa's Auditor General will release another report on the distribution of coronavirus emergency funds in November. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. El Salvador's civil war was long and brutal. The fighting lasted more than 12 years between 1979 and 92. Amid the cruelty and violence, one incident surpasses others in its horror. The 1989 murder of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her 15-year-old daughter.
The priests were shown no mercy. During the night, gunmen invaded their dormitory, clubbed them, dragged them out to a lawn, and shot them.
This all happened on the campus of San Salvador's UCA, the Central American University. Five of the priests killed were Spanish citizens. Today, a court in Madrid sentenced a former Salvadoran colonel to 133 years in prison for the murders. Kate Doyle is with the National Security Archive at George Washington University and provided testimony at the trial. What exactly did the court determine, Kate?
The court found retired Colonel Inocente Montano guilty on 5 counts of murder related to state terrorism. That is how the Spanish court could try a case in Madrid that occurred in San Salvador 31 years before. They were able to use terrorism laws to apply something called universal jurisdiction, which is a legal principle that essentially permits cases of terrorism or crimes against humanity to be heard and prosecuted in countries all over the world.
And Montano, this former Salvadoran colonel, he had been living in the U.S., and the U.S. extradited him to Spain, correct?
That's right, and it was very unusual and an extremely important precedent because the United States in general does not subscribe to neither universal jurisdiction nor, in broader terms, to international human rights legal efforts around the world, including what goes on at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So for the United States to recognize, at least to the extent of extraditing Colonel Montano to Spain, the principle of universal jurisdiction that operated in that case was vital. Mr. Montano was working in a candy factory outside Boston when he was arrested in, I believe, 2012 or 13, and finally extradited to Spain in 2017.
What was Montano accused of? What were the charges that he faced in this trial?
Well, he was a senior official in charge of public security in El Salvador at the time of the killings. And he, along with 19 other very high-ranking military officers in the Salvadoran army, were indicted in this case on charges of having planned, designed, and ordered the murder of the Jesuit priests, including the rector of the Central American University, Ignacio Ellacuría, a very well-known public intellectual, someone who was beloved by many Salvadorans. He wrote broadly, he spoke broadly. He was despised by the Salvadoran military. So Colonel Montano, along with 19 other senior military officers who are still living in impunity, those who are still alive, were indicted for having planned his murder and the murder of the other Jesuit priests.
So this happened 30 years ago, and for 3 decades, families, lawyers, and witnesses kept pushing this case forward. Why did it take on such importance? Why did they continue, even when it looked like it was becoming a victim of time?
Well, I think, you know, for Salvadorans, for Latin Americans, and for our own country, for the world over, to see a crime that bold, that brutal, that barbaric, carried out on the grounds of a famous university, again, against scholars, public intellectuals, Catholic priests, and to see the photographs of those 6 men lying in the grass with their heads shot, and to know that nothing happened. Nobody was prosecuted who actually planned this killing on the grounds that these priests were in some way linked to the left in El Salvador. That was what the military officials believed. That impunity, that lack of justice, that failure to investigate that case was so profoundly frustrating that their families, the Jesuit community, human rights organizations all over the world simply couldn't let it sit like that in impunity. And so these organizations, those families, that Jesuit community fought for more than 3 decades to get this case into the courtroom.
You uncovered documents that were key to the case, and you testified before the court. What evidence did you find in the documents that you managed to get declassified, and what was convincing to the court?
The documents are replete with the meetings that were held between the senior military officers prior to the killing. They describe a public campaign by the Salvadoran army to smear the Jesuits, in particular, again, Rector Ellacuría, whom they very pointedly hated. And finally, details about that very night. So these embassy cables from 1989, these CIA station reports, these defense attaché intelligence briefings, these were sent up to Washington before, during, and after the assassination of the Jesuits. And they are full of context and factual details that helped the court make their decision today.
How did the U.S. have all these documents?
The United States supported the government and the military in the Civil War against the leftist armed organization, FMLN, throughout the Civil War, with weapons, with training, and ultimately with more than $5 billion in support and assistance, both military and economic assistance. That relationship, the fact that the Salvadoran army was a key ally of ours in the sort of anti-communist fight that we believed we were waging in Central America at the time, that meant that our U.S. officers living in San Salvador were constantly reporting up to Washington about what they were seeing and what they were hearing. And the relationship between the Salvadoran military and specifically the very officers indicted in the Jesuit case were close colleagues, buddies, allies of U.S. military and diplomatic officers serving in the embassy in El Salvador at the time.
The defendant, Inocente Orlando Montano, this former colonel and ex-deputy defense minister, had been, as you said, living and working just outside Boston, not far from our studios, when he was extradited to Spain in 2017. What's next for him? Where is he going to serve out the sentence?
He'll serve out the sentence in Madrid, and the case will continue to go forward. I mean, the Spanish have asked for the extradition of the surviving accused from El Salvador, and El Salvador to date, although several have been arrested, and it's not quite clear what they plan to do, but so far has refused to carry out the extradition. So it remains to be seen whether the court system in El Salvador has the wherewithal to proceed with that case. But there are prosecutors that have been pulling together evidence, presenting it to the court, and they hope that a national court case against the perpetrators of the assassination of the Jesuits can now go forward.
Kate Doyle with the National Security Archive speaking with us about the sentencing today in Spain of a former colonel in El Salvador. Kate, thank you very much for explaining this.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. Even before the pandemic hit, Netflix was huge in this country. The company's CEO, Reed Hastings, has global ambitions, though, partly because he has to.
But it's also because he's got a quite considerable debt pile that has been financing Netflix's massive expansion.
Banking on binge-watching across the planet. That story's ahead. You're on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from PRX and GBH Boston. On the Greek island of Lesbos, thousands of asylum seekers are spending another night in the streets. Earlier this week, a fire destroyed the refugee camp where about 12,000 people were living. The conditions at Moria camp were already notoriously bad, but now these thousands of people are finding themselves in what they say is an even worse situation. The World's Lydia Emanalidou reports from Greece, and a quick note, we're only using first names for people's safety.
The year she spent living at Moria, Fatima felt stuck in limbo as she waited for her asylum application to be processed. Now that the camp is burned to the ground, she's stranded here. Fatima, who's 66, sits on a blanket spread out over dirt on the side of the road. She's cradling her one-month-old grandchild. She says Moria was overcrowded, filthy, food was scarce, but at least there they had a shelter over their head. Now, she says, she doesn't even have a blanket to cover her grandchild from the scorching sun during the day and the cold winds at night. Fatima is one of thousands who have spent the last three nights in the area surrounding the now burned-down camp. Some are on sidewalks, others in parking lots, and even in a cemetery. The vast majority of the people here, like Fatima, are from Afghanistan. Many are children.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Thank you.
As I walk around in the evening, they crowd around me and ask me to interview them.
Afghanistan.
6-year-old Asma is from Afghanistan.
We
Another migrant from Afghanistan, his name is Aziz, he's 23, helps me translate.
So she says that everything got fired. We've got nothing here, clothes, food, and anything. I just have this pair of slippers and no shoes. So what should I do now here?
People who did manage to save some of their belongings have stuffed them inside dumpsters for safekeeping, others in plastic crates they drag around with them. People here tell me they're exhausted, hungry, and thirsty. Greek authorities are distributing some food and water throughout the day, but 17-year-old Murtaza of Afghanistan says it's not enough. Earlier that day, he had to push his way through a huge crowd to try to get supplies for him, his 5 siblings, and his parents.
Some people take, but all didn't take. All people couldn't take the food.
Because it was too many people.
Yeah, it was too many people.
Before the fire, many migrants would venture out to the port city of Mytilene to get food from local shops, but now the area they're in is barricaded and heavily guarded by police. They're not allowed to leave. Greek authorities say they're doing that to control the situation and to prevent a coronavirus outbreak on the island. Just before the fire, there were at least 35 confirmed COVID-19 cases inside Moria. Migrants say because of the blockades, they can't get things that they need, like medication. Gurban of Afghanistan shows me a prescription written out for his wife and newborn baby. The fire broke out just one day after his wife returned from the hospital where she gave birth. The baby is just 7 days old.
You showed them this prescription and the police won't let you go and get the medicine?
He says the police don't let them to go to the city and get the medicine.
When I ask a Greek policeman about this, he tells me he doesn't know about the specific situation and can't comment.
So it's 8 p.m. and the sun has set at this point, it's dark.
Right around this time, Aziz gets a startling message, a warning that the area we're in might come under attack tonight or another night.
I've got a text message that there is a fascist group of people that they are attacking here, and it's so scary. Yeah.
Anti-migrant groups from the local community and even from abroad have been known to show up to refugee encampments on the island to harass asylum seekers and stir up trouble. Despite all the difficulties, some people find the strength to enjoy the cool hours of the evening. A few play ball. Behind them, a group of about 20 children hold hands in a circle, singing and dancing around a Greek policeman patrolling the area. Under the clear night sky, a man approaches me to ask a question.
You're asking if I have any information about when...
Yes, when moving them refugees.
He wants to know if I have any information about if and when they'll be moved to another location. I tell him I know the Greek government has already transferred some unaccompanied minors to the mainland, that they said they'll bring ships to house some of those stranded on the streets, that Germany and France said they'll come up with a plan to help. He asks me when and seems frustrated that I don't know.
It's now almost 10 p.m. and some people are starting to go inside their tents. If they have them, very few people do. Most people have just a blanket or two on the pavement.
By the time I leave at 1 in the morning, the area is completely quiet except for the occasional whispers, snores, and baby cries. No attacks reported here this evening. Just thousands of people hoping to wake up to a better tomorrow. For the world, I'm Lydia Manoulidou on Lesbos, Greece.
You can connect with us on social media to join the conversation about the stories that keep you thinking and follow the team of journalists that report them. We are at The World on Twitter. It's also where you can connect with Lydia as she continues to report from the ground from Greece throughout the weekend. Okay, I am happy to admit it. I'm a big fan of The Crown, the Netflix series about Queen Elizabeth.
On days like today, ask yourself, in the time I've been on the throne, what have I actually achieved? For the time.
The history, the intrigue, the political rivalries, a bit of romance, and that unfamiliar feeling that, yes, the royals are actually human. The Crown is one of the most successful programs on Netflix, and it's one of the many shows that have catapulted the California-based movie and streaming company into a global company. Reed Hastings is co-founder and co-CEO of Netflix. He's a guest in this week's edition of the podcast, The Economist Asks. He spoke with Anne McElvoy, podcast host, and she joins us from London. Anne, Reed Hastings has a new book out, so he's making the rounds. As co-founder of one of the most influential companies in the world, where does he see Netflix in this hyper-connected, data-driven entertainment universe?
He makes absolutely no bones about the fact, Marco, that he sees it as a global company, that it has global ambitions. And that's partly because Reed Hastings just is that kind of ambitious magnate. He doesn't like to think small. But it's also because he's got a quite considerable debt pile that has been financing Netflix's massive expansion. And the market in the US looks as if it could be nearing saturation. He wouldn't see it that way, but a lot of analysts think so. So he needs to go elsewhere. And I think that is what is powering this big worldwide push in drama and in entertainment.
Does he see Netflix being bigger than Hollywood at some point?
I think he thinks that Netflix is Hollywood. I think that's one of the really interesting things to me that came out of the interview, is that I think he thinks these old kind of verticals are pretty much dead. Yes, he believes he's taken on the studios and in many cases and won. But the reason that he talks such a lot, even more than you, about The Crown, is that he likes those big brands which are very much situated in one culture, British royalty, but which travel, where people find their own experience, the experiences of where they are, somehow reflected in the story. You could say that was the old DNA of Hollywood. He says it's the DNA of Netflix, and it will enable it to expand and keep on expanding.
I remember first signing up to Netflix, I don't remember when, and this crazy idea that they'd mail you DVDs and you'd mail them back after you watched them. It seems like another lifetime ago. Now with the pandemic and binge watching, Netflix is practically a lifeline. It's hard to imagine living without it. How much bigger can the company get?
Well, 200 million subscribers worldwide, obviously a fantastic growth trajectory there behind Netflix. There's been a silver lining from the pandemic for Netflix, with huge growth since COVID got going. Of course, we're all sitting on our sofas, we're going out a lot less. At the same time, there is some criticism that the tentacles of Netflix, that all our sofas, if you like, too connected in this mutant monster sort of metaphor, that it's just going around the world and it's sucking us all in to a sort of undifferentiated Netflix view. That's the flip side of that. Here's what he has to say about that tension.
We definitely want to serve people all over the world, because then, you know, we want to create a broad community of storytelling. But it's very competitive. I mean, Disney Plus has grown to over 60 million members in, you know, less than 1 year. And it took us, you know, 12 years to get to 60 million. I mean, they're on a phenomenal growth. So there'll be a lot of competition as everyone realizes the internet is the way to go.
And does that mean more focus outside the US, just to put the question with a slightly straighter face?
We've always had a big focus of doing content from anywhere in the world to everywhere.
What about the Chinese domestic market? That seems to have been hard for you to crack. Do you think you'll be in China within 5 years, 10 years?
No, I mean, China blocks Netflix as they do YouTube, and they closed down the Disney streaming service that used to be in China. They closed down the Apple streaming service that used to be in China. So unfortunately, they're closing themselves off from Western media. So there's no chance. So we're focused on the entire rest of the world, but no China.
Our China Affairs editor, Gadi Epstein, had this question. He said, do you still feel or sense pressure around you not to offend China in Netflix commissioning and production of content because stars and directors would fear offending Beijing, regardless of the platform and your honest assessment that it's not the place for you?
I don't notice that. I mean, it is true that we don't want to do simplistic vilification. And we don't want to, you know, fall into those tropes. But there's no special consideration about Chinese sensibilities. We get to program for the whole rest of the world and to do that really well.
That's Reed Hastings, co-founder and co-CEO of Netflix. He's this week's guest at our friends over at the podcast, The Economist Asks. Anne McElvoy, Reid addressed China. What about Africa? What about India?
Africa and India are huge potential growth markets for Netflix. And if you talk to a lot of drama companies around the world, that's very much where Netflix is pointing interest. It's also telling that the way that they go about it is partly to get dramas out of those countries, out of those territories, but is also to make the kind of content or buy in the kind of content from other providers that they think will reach into those areas. The Crown is a very good example. It's made in a way. It makes the reign of Her Majesty the Queen seem like an endless kind of world tour, which is quite handy because she pops up almost everywhere over a 50-year period. So you know, that's a good example where you will see something like that that comes out of a very specific culture, but is seen, then it resonates, and also it has challenges and drama and tensions into other parts of the world. But I think the message is that they want to commission a lot more from those territories directly and are trying to figure out creatively how to do that, because of course Africa is a continent. It's not just one country. What you commission in one part of Africa just drops like a stone in another part of Africa. That's the tension of trying to do a truly global drama-based product.
Was there anything in your interview with Reid Hastings that surprised you, Anne?
A couple of things. I said, I was a bit rude, actually. I said, I think a lot of their series twos are terrible. I'd just be watching Dead to Me. Series one was absolutely brilliant. Series two was really not brilliant. Of course, he told me this was not the case at all and had nothing to do with the fact that once you've watched quite a lot of Netflix, they've got your data, so they're kind of happy. But I think there is a challenge there, and we argued about that. That's quite an interesting tussle if you listen to it. The other thing was really about smoking and drug use, because I think Netflix overall, you could make the case that there is a sort of normalization. Of course, drama is going to show extremes. We had a good tussle about that, and he really declared himself in terms of the libertarian. He said, look, I had the same views, he said himself, about computer games and those games that kids are always playing where they're going around sort of killing half the world. And he said, but it doesn't mean they go out and do it. We did have a debate about that, but it was obvious to me that he didn't really accept that he felt that people could separate drama from a normalization of bad and poor conducts. Make up your own mind whether you agree with him.
Anne McElvoy, host of the podcast The Economist Asks. To hear more of her conversation with Netflix's Reid Hastings, check out The Economist Asks podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Anne McElvoy, good to speak with you again. Thank you.
Great to be with you as always, Marco.
When you see a headline like this, Zambia's president mourns death of good luck fish, you can't just leave that alone. Just when you thought 2020 couldn't get any worse, Mafishi has died. Mafishi was a bream that lived in a pond on the campus of Copperbelt University, one of Zambia's largest universities. For 20 years, Mafishi lived in this pond until this week when he died. The cause of death is unknown, but it has really upset a lot of people. Mafishi! Anguished cries there on the campus of Copperbelt University. There were also candlelight vigils. At Mafishi's pond, students gathered and sang the national anthem in his honor. This outpouring of grief is, of course, unusual for a fish, until you hear what Mafishi meant to students. Copperbelt Student Union President Loris Kasonde spoke to the BBC.
This fish was a symbol of good luck, was a symbol of hope and strength towards the students.
Kasonde said you could go to the pond before exams, and if Mafishi surfaced, it meant you do well.
This fish is irreplaceable.
If Mafishi stayed submerged, though, no amount of studying could help you. Even the president of Zambia, Edgar Lungu, sent his condolences. On Facebook, he quoted Gandhi, saying the greatness of a nation can be judged by how it treats its animals. But now the BBC is reporting that Mafishi's body has been stolen. It had been in a freezer waiting to be embalmed, and now some Zambians are speculating, what if Mafishi is still alive somewhere? Because it's 2020, and even a fish story is subject to conspiracy theories.
Viva! Viva!
The national lockdown in the UK is over, but there's now concern of another wave of coronavirus, and already warnings are coming from the health secretary there that a second national lockdown is possible. So more time at home, more time in front of the TV. That'll be an advantage for a campaign that is addressing domestic abuse during lockdown, partnering with a British soap opera. In the UK, the BBC series EastEnders is their general hospital. It's been on air since 1985. EastEnders developed a storyline this season that's focused on the risks of domestic violence during the pandemic.
I'm divorcing him. That's where I was this morning. I was seeing a lawyer. And no one knows about this yet, just the lawyer and you.
In the series, a young woman has been preparing to leave her abusive husband. His abuse has escalated while she's been trapped with him during lockdown. The show has already warned viewers that during the season, she will be murdered by her husband. EastEnders worked with the charity Women's Aid in the UK on the storyline, and Women's Aid has also been studying how lockdown is impacting people with abusive partners. Sophie Francis Cansfield is a senior campaigns and policy officer at Women's Aid. Your organization recently led an investigation into how lockdown was impacting people with abusive partners, Sophie. What were the findings?
Unfortunately, the impact on women and children really showed that domestic abuse got worse during the pandemic and lockdown. So 2/3 of survivors who identified as currently experiencing abuse told us that their abuser had started using lockdown restrictions or using the kind of COVID-19 virus as part of the abuse. So it became a tool for abusers to carry out their abuse on women. The research highlighted that women reported that their abuse they experienced got worse during the pandemic. And obviously, during the lockdown, this was particularly true for women who were living with their abuser during the time. And unfortunately, all of this lockdown period meant that their access to escape and support networks was extremely limited. It made it much more difficult for women to seek support or to leave their abuser. And over 3/4 of survivors living with an abuser said they felt they could not leave or couldn't get away because of the pandemic.
Sophie, let's talk about the EastEnders plotline. How did Women's Aid work with the show to make sure these kinds of relationships were being portrayed accurately?
So Women's Aid have been working on the BBC EastEnders storyline for the past 2 years now. At Women's Aid, we know the reality of domestic abuse is that not everyone survives, but unfortunately, this isn't a kind of well-known fact, but for those of us campaigning to end domestic abuse, this storyline and EastEnders provided us with a platform to let viewers know. So at the moment, 3 women will be killed in the UK every fortnight, and that is a statistic that was even higher during lockdown when we saw 16 women murdered during the period of lockdown. So it's really benefited as an informative platform. It's been incredibly eye-opening for so many EastEnders viewers to learn that fact.
Sophie, during lockdown, what kinds of resources are available for people facing these abusive situations?
During the official lockdown, it was difficult for women and children to escape and access support, but organizations like Women's Aid have been providing a number of direct services to women. We firstly have our live chat helpline, and this is a kind of safer way to access some support, particularly if an abuser might also be in the property, so it wouldn't be safe to make a telephone call. This can just be all done kind of over chat. But we also have our Survivors Forum, which is an online resource for survivors and can be accessed 24/7, but it is a real place where survivors can support each other and share their experiences, which can be really empowering and beneficial.
Sophie, why is it important, do you think, for stories like this to be seen by a wide audience? Have you been getting feedback about this collaboration with the EastEnders soap opera?
We've kind of heard from women who said that thanks to the storyline, they've now been able to recognize what they were experiencing after being in a relationship with their abusive partner, some for almost 5 decades. They are now seeking professional help, and I think it's thanks to those responsibly executed TV dramas that we're able to raise that awareness alongside giving information about how survivors can get life-saving help and support that has the ability to really kind of change lives.
Sophie Francis Cansfield is a senior campaigns and policy officer at the charity Women's Aid in the UK. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
From the East End of London to the West Side of the African continent, some life music lessons. That's the voice of Afel Bokoum, a guitarist from Mali. This is from a 2006 documentary. Afel Bokoum is talking about the music we're hearing, a sound that comes from the guitar of his mentor, the late, great Ali Farka Touré. Bokoum says that in all of Ali Farka's guitar expressions, he hears the voice of Ali. It's an important lesson for any musician. Make your voice come out of your instrument. That's your signature. Everyone says Afel Bokoum is chasing things they'll never have, but you already have your voice. Know it. Use it. Which gets us nicely to the voice of the trombone played here by Vin Gordon. Jamaica's Scatolites legend appears on Afel Bokoum's new album. Bombolo Lilo is the title of the single, a song that serves as an up-tempo warning to Africans who dream of leaving for Europe. It's a risk, sings Afel. There's more to be lost than gained. New music from Afel Bokoum from Mali to get you into the weekend. When we're not on the air, you can always find us at theworld.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You take care, be strong, stay healthy. I'll see you back here Monday.